This is episode 23 of the Software Freedom Law Show for March 16th, 2010. Hi, I'm Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn.
And I'm Aaron Williamson.
And this is the Software Freedom Law Show, and we have a special co-guest or co-host.
No, he's not a guest anymore.
Special
he's
co-host. I corrected myself.
Occasional contributor.
Valued occasional guest. No, I said like, not guest.
See, you're doing it now, too. It was an accident. He's an occasional co-host.
Occasional
a
co-host.
A special host.
Puppeteer.
If he's a special host and we're not special hosts.
Well, that means he gets more infections, right? Because you're a host that you're a host. Yeah, you know, it's like
thanks.
I guess that wasn't a very complimentary thing to say. But my point is that I was trying to make the joke about host as in biology versus host as in a, because we could say presenter.
Bradley, are you playing fast and loose with virus metaphors?
No. I think I'm going to say you're an occasional presenter.
Bradley Kuhn's metaphors are viral.
Occasional presenter.
That's fine.
Yeah. Because that's what I say in the UK. They call them not hosts, but presenters. And if you're a host...
Either way, I'm happy to be here.
If you're a host, you can't use...
I want to wait for the day when you're not happy to be here.
If you're a host, you have to run all those guest operating systems.
Are we still doing this?
Yeah. We got a complaint that we have too much annoying chatter.
That we had too much annoying chatter in...
One time.
Yeah.
One time!
I actually agreed.
You were involved in
I
the
I kept
chatter?
Trying to cut it off, and you kept...
But I was talking about Fab.
You were talking about the
it.
Snow.
No, you were talking about snow. I was talking about...
Well, you
about...
kept looking outside, and... No? That was me? That was all in my head?
Yeah.
All right.
So we unfortunately had to, because we should acknowledge this because we announced it, had a guest lined up. Unfortunately, we had a scheduling conflict, and it looks like we're going to have our guests that we promised last show on the next show, we hope. We're going to try to get this guest because it's a very exciting guest booked, and we hope it will happen.
Yeah, and it's a good follow from the last show.
Right. So if you wanted the follow-up on trademarks, you're going to have to skip to the following show, which doesn't exist at the time you're first hearing this, but may if you're listening to Backlog. And we're instead going to talk about a listener-requested topic.
And that topic is the public domain. And I've been brought in, I'm not sure why, I think purportedly as a guest expert, but I'm not going to hold myself out
as
a particular expert.
Because it's fun when we have you here.
And you and I have had a lot of discussions outside of a podcast about public domain issues. So our hope is to maybe continue those kinds of discussions we've been having about this issue.
And also it's an issue that people ask us about a lot.
Well, it has some historical magic in the free software world. There was a time back when we were all young and contributing to code bases, and there was this concept that if you didn't want to sign a copyright assignment form, so in the old days when FSF would ask for copyright assignment, some people would not want to do a copyright assignment, and the answer was, oh, you can just put your work into the public domain instead. You can disclaim your copyright. And this was a concept that, because it started so early in the late 80s in the free software world, it spread very extensively. And people who didn't want to bother to put their name on their code or would rather, it was such a small patch, they didn't really want any copyright interest in it. They would rather live without the copyright because it was just too much hassle to even put their name in the file, even though it technically was a copyrightable contribution. They would say, oh, I disclaim my copyright. I put this into the public domain. You'll see posts on mailing lists going back to the 80s of people saying that. But it's all like bull, right? You can't actually do
well,
that?
Well, it's, you know, I mean... It's very confusing, and I guess I never get tired of talking about how we're merely U.S.-qualified lawyers, and we have a very U.S. perspective on the law. And in fact, we're... Aaron and I are both New York lawyers, too. Are you admitted in another jurisdiction?
No.
No, yeah, nor I. So we've got a really focused view. But in the United States, it's very unclear as to what the legal significance is of the public domain, in part because it's not referenced in that way in the Copyright Act. So the Copyright Act doesn't say, if you want to contribute your work to the public domain, here's what you need to do.
Right. So when we refer to the public domain, by and large, what we're talking about are works that have passed from copyright, that their term of copyright has expired, and they're no longer under the copyright regime, and anybody can use them. That's sort of how the public domain classically grew.
Wait a second. Works fall into the public domain. Copyright expires. When does that happen again? I've never heard of that before.
Well,
nothing written in my lifetime that's happened to, as far as
well,
I know.
Well, that's because you're very software focused.
Well,
no, I don't know. Is there anything that was made after the year of my birth that's fallen into the public domain yet?
No. So, that's definitely true.
Fallen in from a term expiration. Right. Because there are other works that could be public domain, which we'll get into after.
Yes. Okay. So the term of copyright is something that Lawrence Lessig has talked a lot about and is now, I think, desperately trying to move past. But essentially, the first Copyright Act provided a very short term for copyright. Subsequent developments in copyright law, both in the United States and internationally, provided for longer and longer terms. The last time the copyright term was lengthened was in 1998 by an act dedicated posthumously to Sonny Bono that essentially, for most works, extended copyright so that it is the life of the author plus 70 years. And there are various exceptions for corporate works, for unpublished versus published works, et cetera, et cetera. But it also retroactively extended the life of copyrights that were about to expire. So Bradley is correct that nothing created during any of our lifetimes, certainly, has accidentally fallen into the public domain.
So it's a joke that the copyright terms are perpetual, and you'll hear, for example, Carl Fogel, who's the executive director of Question Copyright, saying that it's just an indefinite monopoly.
Well,
as Stallman's term, which I always like, I don't know if he was the first to say this, but he often says it, perpetual copyright on the installment plan. You lobby Congress to buy a little longer copyright every time something's about to expire. So effectively, that way of making public domain effectively doesn't happen, although theoretically it's possible. It's effectively not happening in our culture. And all the more reason that people would want to, if they believe in a public domain, want to dedicate their works into it. But as Karen pointed out, there's nothing in the statute that says this. The statute talks about public domain in terms of expiration issue, not how to put it in. So is it, I ask my question again, because you guys haven't been good lawyers, you're avoiding the hard question. But is it the fact that you can't dedicate something to the public domain? Is it bunk when you say, I put this in the public domain?
I don't think that that's true. So the mechanism by which a copyright holder can put something into the public domain is something that has existed in copyright law for a long time called abandonment. And so there are two closely related legal concepts here, abandonment and now I'm forgetting the name of the other one, but essentially the other one was when a copyright was lost to the public domain because you didn't include a copyright notice. Mm-hmm. This is a requirement that existed
in the old days.
In the old days, but no longer exists. So you can't, nothing falls into the public domain that way anymore. But abandonment,
that was in the 70s, incidentally. So
right.
But the 76 copyright changed it,
right.
Basically.
Right. But it's still possible to abandon one's copyright, with a clear statement, indicating that you intend to abandon your copyright, and this it was a common law principle before, or when copyright was a common law thing, and is now still recognized as far as I know.
But not all countries are common law countries. The countries. That
oh,
have
we're
a
still talking
law,
about the United
the
States, and there
right.
are some really strange situations where the common law copyright still. You know, pop up every now and again. An example of that is the sound recordings. And there's a famous case called Naxos that's kind of, but we're talking about software. But there's an interesting play between the common law copyright and the federal statute.
Right. But I guess what I mean to say is that this common law principle of abandonment, it doesn't appear to have disappeared with the 1976 Act. And I think we're fairly safe in saying that it is still possible to abandon a copyright to the public domain. now under the current regime.
Now, how does a concept like estoppel interact with that as well, right? So, so if I get up and say, I disclaim my copyright, I do not want my copyright interest, then I come back 10 years later and say, ah, but I actually do want the copyright and I want to enforce it now. Doesn't that give the other party you're trying to enforce against an estoppel of saying, I acted on in good faith on your statements that you made, and if they are legitimately your statements, how can you come and enforce the copyright now?
Sure. Well, abandonment is a defense to copyright infringement.
Well, so I guess I'm asking, are there two defenses there? Is abandonment different than estoppel in that case, or is abandonment basically the estoppel defense? Or am I saying stuff that makes legally no sense and I'm playing lawyer when I shouldn't?
That's an interesting question. I mean, it would be not, the defense would be not infringement.
Of course.
So, but, I mean, you wouldn't be stopped from asserting a copyright because there's no copyright. So you would, your first defense would be that there is no infringement of the copyright.
Right, so when you come after me, when I do that, my defense would be, I'm not infringing because I'm relying on the statement. Basically.
Right.
And that's
right. And so then you would have to prove that you had a clear statement from the copyright holder that they abandoned the copyright.
So maybe it's actually, it would be abandonment before estoppel, actually, when you think about it. Like, mm-hmm. You'd first argue there's no copyright, and then you would argue, even if there is copyright, I have a...
So, and actually, there's an interesting concept of things you do in legal arguments that I think would be helpful for our listeners who don't know often how legal arguments are constructed. Often when you guys make a legal argument for something, like when you file papers in court, you argue something first, and then because the judge might hate that argument, you say something like, should this not turn out to work, then my argument would be. And you often stack those, right? When you're making them, you sort of stack them on top of each other. I would argue this, but if that turns out to be wrong, I'll next.
Sure, sure.
There's some great jokes based on that, and I wish I could remember them. Do you know, there's usually like a law school joke about, you know, and, you know, and even if I was speeding, I was not even in the car.
Right.
Kind of thing.
Yeah. I don't know the actual joke.
Is there a term for that, though? Is there a term for that type of argument construction? A jargon term of some sort? Or is that just what you do?
Throwing the book. No. I don't know.
No, I have no idea, yeah.
I just wanted to point
that
out.
But it's certainly something we do. I mean, you know, when we file a complaint, we file every possible cause of action that we might have. And when we file a response, then we, you know, file every possible defense.
Yeah. I just wanted, because Karen was sort of doing that as she was saying you would make this, then that. I want to point out to our listeners it's not that one of them's not true. It's not an example of, or even that one's more true than the other. You just think one has more success possibilities than the other.
It's interesting. I think that it is something that non-lawyers find difficult, but I find that developers tend not to be fazed by that kind of approach. But you never know.
Because should this line of code not exhibit the bug, the following lines
exactly.
of code are more likely to exhibit the bug. And that's how I would narrow down mm-hmm. where this bug is actually being caused from and what lines I would change to fix it.
That is an interesting analogy, and I'm not sure I'm going to use it in the future.
But
going back to your question, estoppel is an equitable defense that basically says... it would not be fair to assert or to, you know, find infringement in this case, or to essentially find damages or whatever. So it's not, I mean, it's estoppel is typically up to the court to sort of weigh the fairness of the situation, and it's not you know, it's sort of changes case by case.
Yeah, it's not necessarily the it's just a defense is the thing. So you don't necessarily want to wind up relying on estoppel, but it is an effective thing to talk about, and we do talk about it a lot and rely on it somewhat. But you know, it's just a matter of in part it's just you can think about it sort of as like a fairness argument. You know, you knew that you know, I thought that the code was licensed a certain way. You knew I thought that, and for, you know, 5 years you didn't say anything, you didn't object, and you knew I was continuing to use it. It's just not fair if you tell me that that wasn't the proper license for the code.
But that's sort of the interesting question. Is it a license or is it non-copyright? Is that a distinction without a difference in this case?
No, it's not a distinction without a difference. I mean, in order to abandon copyright, essentially you're giving up the right to grant or revoke licenses. And, you know, I think that it's probably not possible to say I abandon and then a year later say, no, I assert the copyright. Or at least I think that there would be a solid defense there. Now there is an issue, that's unresolved in the United States, as to whether you can, terminate, a dedication to the public domain. There's a provision of U.S. copyright law that says that you can terminate any transfer or any license to a copyright,
after a certain period.
Right. During a certain window of time, 35 years after you granted the license. Now,
and for a short period of time, it's not indefinitely after 35 years.
Right, exactly. Yeah. You have a brief window, and you have to give notice to the people who have a license, et cetera, et cetera. But since abandonment isn't a license, it's not entirely clear whether you are allowed to terminate a license or terminate an abandonment, during that period of time. So whether you can revoke this abandonment to the public domain is up in the air as well.
But this is such a U.S.-centric conversation, though, isn't it? Because there's not really the same concept of public domain in some other legal systems.
Right.
Well, we get our concept from the U.K.
Well, that's true, and that's why I was talking before about Commonwealth systems mm-hmm. versus other systems. These systems throughout the other parts of Europe that have, mm-hmm. for example, the question of moral rights versus exploitative rights in copyright.
Right.
My understanding is you can't disclaim your moral rights no matter how hard you try.
That's true. And I believe there are jurisdictions even in which moral rights extend beyond the term of copyright.
The exploitative right.
Yeah, the moral rights are in fact indefinite and can't be disclaimed no matter how hard you try, like you said. This makes public domain dedications problematic internationally in a way that copyright licenses aren't. Because, you know, to some extent, for some things, or rather for certain types of provisions of copyright law, there's generally international unity because of all of these treaties that the nations have signed. But because the concept of the public domain varies so greatly internationally, it's not always possible to tell what the public domain dedication means in one country versus another.
So Byrne doesn't give us anything on this? Does Byrne even mention the public? I don't know.
Byrne, I believe, mentions the public domain only insofar as to say that Byrne does not mm-hmm. cause copyright to extend to things which are in the public domain. Mm-hmm. So it essentially said this treaty does not shrink the existing public domain when it was enacted.
When it was enacted. That's interesting, because then the question is, if I'm a U.S. developer who's dedicated something to the public domain, well, actually, that's true anyway under Byrne, because I'm first publication is the U.S., therefore, I wouldn't suddenly magically get moral rights in Europe when I disclaimed the U.S.,
right.
because I was a U.S. developer anyway.
Right.
The question, I guess, really comes up if a European developer tries to just say, I disclaim copyright. Because then the country of first publication is probably their country.
Hmm.
And then the questions of was it ever in the public domain come up? Because, of course, Byrne's respecting public domain that already exists, but did it ever make it there?
And that's a good question. And mm-hmm. I think that, you know, it's worth mentioning here that Creative Commons looked very hard into this issue when they were developing CC0, which is their public domain waiver document that they have another name for it besides waiver, but regardless, that's what it is. It's a public domain dedication in lieu of a license. And they grappled with these international issues and talked to lawyers in many different countries about the public domain the concept of the public domain in various jurisdictions and tried to figure out how to do this as internationally as possible. And the solution that they came up with was to have various fallback positions, like you were saying, sort of what we lawyers do. We say, well, it's dedicated to the public domain, but to the extent that a public domain dedication is impossible in the relevant jurisdiction, mm-hmm. then it is a broad license. And, you know, I waive certain possible causes of action.
Right. I mean, is it worth it to talk about what the differences are between the most permissive license and dedicating a work into the public domain?
I think that's
yeah, let's get to that in a minute, though, because I want to talk a little bit more about CC0 and the problem with it in the free software world. Because I think it's great, the work that Creative Commons did. The problem with it is that no developers will be responsive to it. I know of an example where a developer made a very small, and I think this is actually the kind of example you're going to find everywhere, made a very small change to a program. He just wanted to give it to the project. He was a European developer, so he couldn't actually put it in the public domain in this, you know, a side channel. And I told him, this is not legal advice, as I always do. I said, well, you could try and see if CC0 would work, because that's kind of what you want. And he wrote that to them, and they said, that's... The project literally said, we're not sure if this is compatible with our license. Other Apache 2.0 right. license project. Because they look at it, and it looks like a license document. So they're like, crap, I've got to go show
this
to somebody.
This is another long license that
I've got to show to somebody who knows enough to know if it's compatible with Apache and all this stuff. And like, why can't you just, like, in the end, the developer just licensed under Apache? Because it was like a 10, it was less than 10 line change. It was like a 4-line change. Mm-hmm. But it was clearly, not clearly, but more than likely copyrightable. So he wanted to make sure he did it right. And he knew he couldn't dedicate to public domain because he's a European developer. And yet CC0 doesn't work for him because the free software community doesn't really have the time, inclination, or in some cases even ability to go and learn how these new tools work. They have to stick with what they know. And what they know is a set of licenses they know are approved for inclusion and compatibility, and they know this, I put this in the public domain. And ultimately, it was only because this developer knew me that he knew enough to come to me to say, wait a second, how do I put something in public domain? I heard that I've heard you say things about Europe in the public domain. How do I actually do it? And they're sort of stuck. And this is really problematic in the free software world because everybody who develops generally wants really simple rules they can follow and simple rules that they can understand. And the allure of that public domain question was, you just said, I disclaim copyright and contribute this to the public domain, or some words that sound like that, and it was done.
Right.
And hearing that that doesn't work, not that it doesn't work, it certainly works in the U.S., sounds like, but that it may not be a very good solution all over the world, is somewhat jarring, I think, to developers. We've had talks with Creative Commons about how do we advocate CC0 to the developer community, and I don't have an answer, because I don't know how to make them not see it as another license that I have to learn how it works.
Right. Right. I mean, I think that the advantage of using copyright licenses. So let me say that there's grown up, I think, a sort of ideological camp around public domain, similarly to ideological camps that have grown up around highly permissive licenses and copyleft licenses. Everybody has a different conception of what freedom is. Some people believe that copyleft is more free because it ensures the freedom of users. Some people believe that a very permissive license is more free because you are free to do more things in terms of licensing with the software. And some people believe that taking essentially that same argument even further, that the public domain is the only is the best way to license your code, or, you know, dedicate your code to other people, because then it's even freer because there's no license attached to it. And I don't mean to discredit that at all. I'm not making any kind of ideological arguments here. But the point is that licensing your code under a copyright license seems to be the surer way to make it clear what others can do with your code. Because of these international issues, and because copyright licenses are things that people understand, and things that have been in use in business throughout the world, and because licenses to copyright are more or less, or how you grant a license to copyright is more or less harmonized internationally, whereas the public domain isn't, there's more certainty available, we think, right now, in licensing your code rather than dedicating it to the public domain.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the biggest difference in effect tends to be that with licenses, you're going to be left with notices and required notices and attributions, which you might not.
Yeah, and it's interesting if you read about the license that everybody loves to joke about, which is believed to be the most permissive license ever created, which is the "do what the f you want" license. And I don't say that word because I'm afraid to say that word, but we are marked as non-explicit and in our feed, and I don't want to have to change that marking.
I've said that word before on our podcast.
Really?
Our cast.
You have?
I don't remember that. When we talked about this license.
Oh, we did. You did say it. Okay, yeah. Well.
The WTFPL.
So we'll get kicked out of iTunes, but we don't really care.
It was a long time ago. We would have.
I think iTunes would be the only place that would. I don't even know if we're in iTunes. I don't know if we're in the Zune store. Like Linux, you know, Linux Outlaws is in the Zune store. This is the funniest thing. They're actually one of the most popular podcasts on the Zune.
Oh, really?
Which is really bizarre.
That's amazing.
Well, they get letters from people that say that you can get Zune super, super cheap. And this one guy wrote into Linux Outlaws saying, I bought Zunes for my whole family because they were $10 each or something. Because you can get them so cheap because nobody wants them.
Because nobody wants them.
So that may be why they're so popular in the Zune store. Because it's mainly frugality and not caring about DRM. Having frugality be a higher order issue than DRM.
About the WTF.
One of the things that you read on that license page is it says, basically it's snidely arguing to U.S. people that the reason you can't put things in the public domain is you're U.S.-centric, go away, you U.S. copyright-centric person. It literally says that on one of the pages about the do what the fuck you want license. Oops, I just said it. So it literally says that.
It does?
Yeah, because their argument is basically you can't do it.
And they think it's our fault?
No, well, I think their point is that U.S. people go around saying, oh, I'll just put it in the public domain, and it just doesn't work elsewhere.
Oh, I see.
That's their point. Their point is, you U.S. people, think...
I completely misunderstood what you were saying.
Oh, I'm sorry,
I thought you were saying that it was U.S.'s fault because it's not easy to put things in the public domain here. I thought that's what you were saying.
No, what it's saying is, look, if you are in the U.S., you think you can put things in the public domain. Maybe you guys can, but the rest of us can't. So we need this super hyper permissive license that tells you to do whatever you want.
Yeah. There's another license. I mean, there are a few licenses along these lines. One is the unlicense, I believe.
It won't get our saying unlicense won't get our explicit tagging changed.
No, I don't believe so.
I'm not going to bother to change it.
Maybe we can ask Dan to bleep it.
Yeah, that would be funny, I guess.
We should have one of those like obnoxious radio sound effects, like boy.
Okay, I'm going to ask Dan if he doesn't mind doing that just for the amusement value. So hopefully you heard that, and if Dan says it's too much trouble, you actually heard the word. So there's that. But then Karen also brought up another point, which is the reason the do whatever you want license exists is in part because there actually are requirements even on the highly permissive license. A lot of people say, well, public domain, isn't that just the same as, say, using a modified BSD license or something like that? Or a one-clause BSD? Like, say, the ISC license. But there are differences, right?
Yeah, as Aaron was saying before, you know, it's instead of an abandonment of copyright, it's a license of copyright. And so it basically says you can do all of these things, it's very permissive, but you have to include the license notice and give attribution. So that,
right, but I think it only says, I think the most liberal of those say only in source form, and you don't have to do that in binary form. Mm-hmm.
Right, right. But yeah, you have to include the license itself, I believe, copyright notices, typically, and also the warranty disclaimer. And the warranty disclaimer becomes an issue, because, you know, there's this whole law, at least in the U.S., again, of warranties. There's something called the Universal Commercial Code, which has been adopted by many states, most states.
Do the states say to each other, you're down with UCC?
Yeah, you know me. They they probably say that, although not necessarily in those words. But the UCC essentially says that every product in commerce has implicit warranties attached to it, which, you know, says that the product is fit for a particular purpose and that it's merchantable, and what exactly those mean.
What the hell does merchantable mean? Can I say hell? What the hell does it mean, though? I've seen that my entire free software life. I've seen, this is not a fitness of merchantability or any other part. But what the hell is merchantability? Somebody tell me.
I do not feel prepared to give a full
we need our
Black's,
our Black's Law Dictionary. Should we take a break and come back?
You really want to look it up?
I don't know. I mean, we're a legal show. We can delve into our... The Black's Law Dictionary is just this massive tome of simple definitions, and some of them are exactly as you would think. They're just regular definitions, and some have like this lengthy case history, and it's always sort of, I always find it really interesting to find out whether or not it's one of those like weird archaic legal things, or if it's just a word someone happened to choose.
Okay, so you really want to look this up.
We'll be right back.
Okay. so you have this book, this giant book open.
Yeah. Right. I feel like I should, like, drop it on the table so everyone
now
can
you
hear.
Did.
Yeah.
Speaking of sound effects.
So merchantable is fit for sale in the usual course of trade at the usual selling prices, also termed saleable.
So in other words,
saleable's not even a word. Saleable. That's like how festival pronounced sellable.
Maybe it's about boats.
That's true. I guess it...
No, there's no I. I'm just kidding.
No, but actually, I'm now wondering, is saleable about boats a word? Can you say that boat's saleable?
A sailboat could be
seaworthy.
Saleable.
Seaworthy.
Oh, you actually, you weren't kidding.
No, I was actually wondering, can you say saleable? But you would say seaworthy.
Okay.
That's the word for saleable.
So that's...
So merchant billing means something seaworthy. Is that what we're saying?
It means, and here is a definition from the Uniform Commercial Code, that the goods are fit for the ordinary purposes for which goods of that description are used. So it generally works like that kind of thing is supposed to work.
Yeah, this merchantable in blocks uses usual twice.
Yeah. So it's a very broad thing. And how exactly it applies to a particular piece of software as something that's way outside the scope here.
The Hacker's Dictionary definition.
Go for it.
Can be sold in the canonical way.
All right. Can be sold in the canonical way. But regardless, this warranty and also the warranty of fitness for a particular purpose, which would probably be less applicable to our discussion here, apply to any goods in commerce. At least in states that have adopted the Uniform Commercial Code.
Which is most of them.
Right.
In the US.
Which means that if you distribute software, that you make these warranties unless you disclaim them. And there are somewhat particular ways in which you have to disclaim them.
Yes, you have to shout. You have to put everything in all caps if you want to disclaim your warranty of merchantability.
It doesn't have to be all caps, actually.
Why not?
But it does have to be. It does have to be set apart somehow from the other text.
And, somewhere, lawyers decided putting things in all caps, as ugly as it looks in almost every font.
What lawyers decided was belt and suspenders. So they decided caps lock plus bold, and if possible, plus red. Is the best way to do it because that makes it as distinguishable as they can make it in Word without increasing the font size.
In securities law, since I used to be a securities lawyer, there were certain jurisdictions that require the securities disclaimers to be in all caps. So there are circumstances in the law where they actually do specify.
Was this law written by VMS users? What the hell?
It's hilarious because as soon as something's in all caps, nobody reads it.
Right.
It's like it's so much harder to read when something's
in all caps. I'm going to do this entire podcast in all caps for the rest of the podcast.
Yeah. I mean,
we may have to end the podcast right now.
So going further, tripping further along this aside, I recently read a blog called Typography for Lawyers or some such, which is generally very good advice for lawyers about using typefaces and how you should prepare your legal documents. But one of his points is don't use the all caps method because it doesn't actually work for setting things apart because nobody, as Karen points out, nobody reads things in all caps. Just say in all caps important at the beginning of the section, and that I think would fit the bill a lot better.
Yeah. Well, one of the things, this is a sort of a side point, but one of the things...
These are all side points.
Yeah. In LaTeX, there is a font called Small Caps, which I actually think is better because it's a different font. And it is technically all caps, but what it does is it makes everything a little bit smaller but capitalized. And it looks very nice. And I can't convince lawyers that this is a much better way to do the all caps thing because it actually does set it apart. And it actually is in all caps. So if you actually like all caps, it technically is all caps. But no one will do... Small cap font.
I don't believe you've ever tried to convince me of this.
I have tried to convince lawyers of this, and they have not been convinced. Maybe you can be convinced.
Maybe I can be.
/ SC.
Everything.
Actually, you can do text SC. I'm sorry. I'm old school attack. I open brace / SC, and then close brace. You new school kids, you do / text SC.
Everything does look fancier in small caps.
Doesn't
do that.
So I just looked up the definition of public domain in Black's Law Dictionary, and the very first definition is government-owned land. But then there's an interesting quote at the end of the entry that says that public domain is the status of an invention, creative work, commercial symbol, or any other creation that is not protected by any form of intellectual property. Public domain is the rule. Intellectual property is the exception.
Wow.
We really wish.
Who knew Black's Law Dictionary was so progressive? on copyright
just
issues.
Just wrong in the U.S., unfortunately. but
it's from 96.
It was wrong then, too. it sucks, but it's wrong. So the question really is, though, with regard to the topic of the podcast, these merchantability and various other warranties that are implied, what happens when you say in the U.S., I put this in the public domain? Because you aren't disclaiming those warranties because, and we were just talking about these permissive licenses even or GPL copyleft style licenses, they disclaim them for you as part of the license.
Well,
when you put them in the public domain, you generally don't put a warranty disclaimer.
Well, I mean, you're referring to the general practice that you were talking about before that sort of...
Yes. Because that's the most common way something is in the public domain in the free software world, as
right.
it turns out.
Now, I think that... some disclaimers do include that, and certainly certain waivers of copyright do include disclaimers, including CC0.
Which is good, but what is it just a question of whether if you've done it another way, if you just really simply say, I disclaim copyright in places in the public domain, is there a question then whether you've given an implied warranty of merchantability or fitness for any purpose? I'm sorry, we're no merchantability or fitness for any purpose?
I think that there is some question, and the problem is that the disclaimer has to be conspicuous. And now, when you first disclaim copyright, you might include a warranty disclaimer, and it may be conspicuous at that time. However, unlike with even very permissive free software licenses, like the ISC license, for example, subsequent distributors of the code are not required to keep the warranty disclaimer in there. If you disclaim to the public domain, they can do whatever they want with it, including remove any disclaimers. And so that disclaimer is no longer conspicuous to the second and third hop of distribution. Now, whose fault is that? Can that actually ascribe any liability to you when you, in distributing the code, disclaim the warranty? I don't think that's a question that's been answered. But the point is, it's just another sort of axis of uncertainty with making public domain waivers rather than using copyright licenses that makes, especially, legally sort of cautious users, question whether they should use the code. People are familiar with and they feel safe at this point using free software license code. But this is one reason why public domain license or public domain code that's been abandoned to the public domain rather than has fallen out of copyright might give some pause.
The fortunate side is that these types of simple disclaimers of copyrights in places in the public and placing things in the public domain are primarily used in the free software world on mailing lists for small patches. And somebody actually finding that particular line of code and actually deciding that they had a warranty on that line of code and then going after the person and finding their post in the mailing list where they posted the batch, all of those things happening all together to cause somebody to be gone after for liability is pretty unlikely.
And a lot of people use that analysis when they decide to use public domain or code that's licensed in similar ways. You know, if somebody says this is in the public domain or I disclaim copyright or something similar to that or do whatever the F you want. I just had to laugh when I said that. You know, the thing about that is that person really going to go after you later and say, well, you know, you didn't have permission to use my code. And so a lot of people apply that kind of rationale to public domain works generally.
Sure. And, I mean, unfortunately, there's a risk analysis involved in anything you do with something that does not belong to you.
I say that's fortunately that there's a risk analysis involved generally because otherwise you'd have to always listen to lawyers. Lawyers are always present the worst-case scenario, but sometimes you have to make real life decisions and weigh whether or not something's going to happen. A lawyer is going to tell you that, you know, if there's any possibility of liability whatsoever, then at the end of the day, you know, you have to decide whether there's a real risk of that and whether you want to take that risk.
I guess we should probably wrap up. I think that's a good point to wrap up on, but I would like to add one other thing that we didn't talk about, which is another way things in the U.S. become in the public domain is if they're actually written by the U.S. government.
Right, federal government.
Federal U.S. government, yes.
Right, yes. But of course, there are exceptions as usual. If it's a work contracted for by the U.S. government, but is not a work for hire, then that's not in the public domain, unfortunately.
Correct. And a lot of code funded by the, this is a big thing I have issue with, because a lot of code funded by the government is paid through contractors like Lockheed Martin and so forth. And then Lockheed Martin or whoever gets to keep the copyright, which is very unfortunate because it should be, it's paid for by the U.S. government. It should be available to the taxpayers. But I have run into projects here and there that where stuff has been released in the public domain. There's a project called Foremost that's interesting to me. It was written by somebody at the U.S. Navy, and he's marked, written on contract with U.S. Navy in public domain.
I believe Tor was also written by the U.S. Navy or contracted for by the U.S. Navy originally.
Yeah. And I know of other contractors that have released their work under copyleft licenses, even though they were government contractors. That's an example of copyright.
Yeah, but I would happily give that up if all that code just got in the public domain. Mm-hmm. I don't really want more copyleft code at this cost of more. Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's basically an arms race at that point.
Can I say that that I also looked up the definition for the word free, and it's so fascinating because the definition of costing nothing is definition number 7. After having legal and political rights, after not subject to constraint or domination of another, enjoying personal freedom. It's really interesting. This, I never realized that Black's Law Dictionary was so political.
So free software friendly.
Yeah.
Well, with that,
should we close the book on the show?
I guess so. Okay. I suppose that was equally as lame as me yelling, so... I've been just as lame. And we want to remind everybody, pound SFLC on Freenode. You never find Karen there, but you find Aaron and me there. So
you can donate to us at softwarefreedom.org.
Write to augcast@softwarefreedom.org and ask Karen to hang out on the IRC channel.
Don't do that.
Yes, please. Because maybe we'll convince her.
Maybe.
And 2 weeks, another show.
See you then.
We won't see anybody.
The Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license.
Looking up freedom of the seas?
The principle that the seas beyond territorial waters are not subject to any country's control.
That doesn't make any sense.
It's really not funny.
But freedom of the seas would be like...
Free fishery?
Multiple sea compilers that were released under the GPL? Isn't that freedom of the seas?
Oh.
Fail.
Fail.